Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Unabashed.
The most unpredictable.
Becomes a headline.
The most volatile.
Outrageous behavior.
Unsubstantiated narratives. A battle of personalities.
Welcome to Grant Tamasha, a co-production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in the Hindustan Times. I'm your host, Milan Vaishnav. In India, there are growing signs that the country is slowly exiting the second wave of the COVID pandemic. As people get back to work, localities lift lockdown restrictions, and markets reopen. But the second wave leaves behind a trail of devastation, loss, and widespread anger, and Indians may not have much time to get used to a return to normalcy, as government officials are already warning of a third wave of the virus. To discuss where things stand in India today, I'm joined by the journalist Neha Mussey. Neha is a Delhi-based correspondent for The Washington Post. Before joining The Post in 2019, she reported on politics, conflict, and religious fundamentalism for the Hindustan Times and NDTV. I'm pleased to welcome her back to the show. Neha, good to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Neha, I want to ask you about a very moving and deeply personal essay that you wrote for the Washington Post that was published at the end of May. You wrote about your own family's COVID crisis. And, you know, I'm sure as a journalist, this must have been a difficult decision for you. You're usually reporting on the stories of others. In this case, you're reporting on your own story. You know, tell us a little bit about why you decided to write this piece.
Right. Well, it wasn't an easy decision, and it did take me some time to get to writing it. I didn't write it in real time as it was happening. But I think what happened to my family was quite representative of what was happening to so many others in India. And I obviously had the opportunity and space to tell that story. So in a way, it was kind of like writing it on behalf of all those who went through the same experience of devastation, but didn't really have a chance to share it. And I think it was also partly that this, again, my experience and my family's experience pulled in all these different threads that we were anyway reporting on, which kind of all came together in this story, whether it was like, oxygen crisis or like the overwhelmed health system or missing deaths. So in that sense, this one story told you, gave you a comprehensive view of what was happening in India instead of like, you know, touching at different angles and points. And for those of your listeners who haven't read that piece, I won't be able to go into much detail, but essentially my whole family contracted COVID at the peak of India's second surge. And we went through a whole set of problems in trying to get them help. Some of them did receive help and some didn't. And so I kind of, you know, wrote about that experience of being in the middle of it, as well as reporting it. So I think if this was one of those rare situations where my lived reality, and I guess this is true for many journalists in India who went through this, who went through similar things, where our lived realities collapsed seamlessly into what we were reporting on. So if I hadn't had this experience, I would have tried to find someone else to write about. But given that I had seen everything firsthand and given how difficult the situation was, I felt that I could only honestly write about myself than to try to distill what was happening to others.
You know, one of the things you talk about in the piece, Neha, is that you yourself, in the middle of trying to take care of your family and friends, contracted COVID and had to quarantine with a friend. Tell us a little bit about what that was like. I mean, I'm sure it must have been a really frightening experience given what was happening around you.
Yes and no. And I say that because I think by the time I had COVID and most of my family had already contracted it, that it didn't, and they were, my mom and dad had a much worse, infection than I did, that it didn't, like my threshold for bad was really already very high. So in that sense, in a slightly grim way, it wasn't so scary. I think, and again, because I was lucky that a friend and I tested positive at the same time, so we could isolate together, where she actually took care of the daily stuff, where and I could focus on my writing and reporting and taking care of my family and attending to hospital calls. So in that sense, I was sort of lucky. I think the unknowns at that time were so many that it was impossible to, to try to do anything in case something went wrong. There were no hospital beds. The tests would take like 4 days to come. Medicines were in short supply, though you could get them. Doctors were available on call irregularly. So all of those things, of course, were not easy. But given the extent and scale of what was happening outside, my own COVID experience was pretty mild, I would say. Yeah.
I want to ask you one more thing about this story, and we'll link to it, of course, in the show notes. And it was a deeply sort of harrowing piece to read. You write about losing your grandfather to COVID and not having proper time to grieve because, there were just too many logistics to worry about. Now, of course, you're focused on helping your family recuperate, get back on their feet. We hear a lot, and there have been numerous stories about the physical toll the crisis has taken on people's families, on their bodies. But how would you characterize the sort of mental or psychological impacts the second wave has had? I was talking to a friend the other day, and we were sort of discussing how, so much of the country is probably suffering from some kind of PTSD, right? Given the sorts of things they've had to endure.
Absolutely. And again, I think maybe it's too soon to even assess that impact because there is still so much to do. Like right now, people have just about recovered or come back from hospitals, and there are hospital bills to pay and medical arrangements to make. That the emotional toll of it hasn't really registered fully, I would say, at least for me. And I think it would probably be the case for a lot of other people. People have, jobs to go to or work to look for. But I think what this crisis has done, unlike in any other previous crisis that I have seen or reported on, is that there was a sense of universalization of grief. What you were seeing on the news, what you were reading on the papers was also happening either to you or to your friends or family. And everyone would know someone who was going through some kind of problem. I mean, there would be a few people who may have remained untouched, luckily. And even if you were in that category, your social media, your WhatsApp groups were overwhelmed with desperate pleas for help. So it was impossible to remain untouched in any which way. And I think last week, for instance, someone who I barely knew and had never met or interacted with, but followed on Twitter, passed away. And there was so many people suddenly sharing stories of that person. Again, most people hadn't met, but only interacted on Twitter. That at the end of the evening, after I saw some of those messages, I was crying too. Each loss feels very personal now because you've seen it all play out in front of your eyes.
I guess this is sort of a good segue to talking about the current situation on the ground. You had a recent piece in the Post in which you note that, the case numbers across India have improved dramatically, but the country is still experiencing anywhere between 1,500 to 2,000 deaths per day. We know that those death numbers are a severe undercount. But you write that local authorities in Delhi, which was hit extremely hard in the second wave, in many ways it felt like the epicenter, those authorities are preparing for an inevitable, quote-unquote, third wave. What exactly are authorities doing to get ready for what could be a third wave of this crisis?
Right. So this is a difference, I would say, I have noted at the end of this second wave that appears to be the end from the end of the first wave, where India and authorities went into a self-congratulatory mode and didn't talk about preparing for the second wave, which, as we had known at that time, did come in, were going to come, and countries like the US and UK had a terrible time managing them. This time, instead of that complacency, what I see is people actually trying to make plans. And some of those include the problems that we did see in the second round. So, for instance, Delhi doesn't have an oxygen plant, a large oxygen plant, which they plan to set up, but that will take, more than a year to get ready. So they are trying to set up smaller oxygen plants. Large size hospitals are trying to make in-house plants. The oxygen storage capacity is being increased, as well as some experts have suggested that children may be most vulnerable in the third wave. And so there are plans afoot to try and have more ICU beds for children, the kind of masks that would fit for children. So there are various things happening, not just in Delhi, but also in Maharashtra in particular as well. They were the first ones off the ground to start preparing for a third wave. Of course, when and how that will come remains unknown, but that's the difference this time, that states are actually trying to do something about it.
But obviously, when the rubber meets the road, the most foolproof form of prevention is vaccination. We know that India is lagging well behind, at least on a per capita basis, when it comes to vaccinating the population. The central government's vaccine policy has come under fire from a number of sources, not least, India's own state governments, right? The prime minister recently gave a nationwide address in which he announced a complete rethink of how the government is going to vaccinate its citizens. What, to the best of your knowledge, is the new policy going forward?
Okay, so the new policy going forward is actually the old policy. In the sense that the central government is now going to be in charge of the bulk procurement of vaccines again, instead of the state governments. So from June 21st onwards, 75% of vaccines will be procured by the center and provided free of cost to all adults in the country at government sites. 25% of the supplies are reserved for private hospitals that can charge a fee for people who vaccinate at private centers. So that's going to be the new policy, and it has gone through various twists and turns and has been quite muddled so far, because in the middle, the government announced that states can now procure their own vaccines and charge people in one age group, but people in another age group would get it for free. So the Supreme Court recently called that arbitrary and irrational, asked the government to, overhaul the system. And this came days after that rap. But it's a bit unfortunate, because in January, when India began its vaccination drive, it was in a really strong position. It had two vaccine candidates, both of which were being produced locally. It has manufacturing heft. Serum Institute is the world's largest vaccine producer by volume. And it also had managed to, escape the worst of the first wave. It had gone off relatively, smoothly compared to what happened next. And yet, despite all of that, the percentage of people who've received vaccines remains very, very low, even if in itself it's a high number. So it remains to be seen now how, going onwards, whether this will pick up, because supply still remains an issue.
We've been reading a lot about inequalities in the vaccination drive. You touched upon this in your reporting as well. One of the things that's come up in recent days is a sort of worrying degree of vaccine hesitancy in certain parts of the country, including in places that you might not expect, like the state of Tamil Nadu, which is one of the most well-developed, richest, most industrialized states. Do we know anything about what seems to be fueling this kind of hesitation, right? I mean, we're seeing reports of pretty large quantities of vaccine that are being wasted because there's not enough take up at certain in certain localities.
Yeah, this is a bit of a complex issue, I think, and given the diversity of class and regional divide, it's also hard to say what is the reason, nationally. I think there are several things to it. One is, of course, lack of awareness. A lot of people, even in urban centers, migrant workers or laborers, do not have enough information about not just about what vaccines do, but also like how to avail of them, where to avail of them. That's definitely one. The government's system of registering for vaccines is also complex. You have to log on to a website and put in your phone number, receive an OTP, register yourself through an identity card, and then book a slot. So it's a complicated system, which again, a lot of people may not be able to do. I have myself had to do it for so many, people who work in households, because they're just not going to be able to do that. And initially, when the drive had opened to everyone 18 above the age of 18, there were just no slots available. So it was actually, trying to like keep playing a game every half an hour, log on and try. So all of those are like logistical difficulties, but there's definitely no doubt that there is also just hesitancy in going and taking the vaccine. And part of it is, I think, related to the fact that a lot of people got the vaccine just when wave was peaking. So my mother, for instance, contracted COVID days after getting the vaccine, and for a lot of people, that can seem as if it was happening after the vaccine. So in rural areas, people were equating getting a vaccine with getting COVID or falling sick. So that's also part of the reason.
You mentioned sort of the situation in rural areas, and I want to ask you to dig a little deeper on this. From a media perspective, I think it's fair to say we're still hearing far too little about what's happening in rural sections of the country. But you spent some time in a village in rural Uttar Pradesh back in May, and you documented pretty frightening accounts from one village that had been really ravaged by the virus. And you spoke with a farmer who told you, quote, "Not a day goes by when there are no deaths. If things continue like this, the village will empty out soon," end quote. Could you tell us a little bit about what you saw during your travels to rural UP?
Yeah, absolutely. Going from Delhi, which had seen 30,000 cases a day, I did not realize that the scale of what was happening in villages would also be so vast. Essentially, what was happening in this village that I went to, a lot of people began to complain of flu-like symptoms, fever and cough, and then they would, in the days to come, they would die. A lot of them developed breathlessness. A lot of them, most of them were never tested, and most of them could not access medical care. Many of them didn't even know what was happening to them and were never diagnosed with COVID. So you found like people sick with these symptoms in many households. And the local health center at the village had no doctor, no testing facility, no medication for COVID or any treatment facilities. The closest you had to go to was a nearby town to get tested, where the day I went, tests ran out by the afternoon, which the technician said happened almost every day. To get an RT-PCR test, you had to wait for 4 days because the results, the samples were sent to a major city close by. A rapid antigen test is what a lot of them were using, which are, not so accurate. To get treatment, you had to, again, go miles. Most people didn't have the financial wherewithal to afford a private hospital. So essentially, people were dying at home in this village. And as we saw on the national scale with super spreader events like the Kumbh Mela and political rallies in West Bengal. We also saw that happening in this in rural UP, where so many people told me that in April there were local village head elections held, which were responsible for this surge. People came from outside. There were gatherings. There were rallies held in villages to elect the head of the village. That contributed to the spread.
So, you know, you mentioned that sort of people dying at home, not being able to access proper care. You know, one of the issues which has emerged, and in fact has been in the news a lot these past couple of days, is the extent of undercounting of COVID-related deaths. You yourself reported a story from the western state of Gujarat talking about the gap between official statistics and, say, what you would find going to crematoria or hospitals. Just last week, authorities in the state of Bihar revised that state's COVID fidelity count by, I think, a whopping like 72%. The data journalist Rukmini, who's been on the show a few times, has uncovered a dramatic unexplained rise in excess mortality in several states, Andhra Pradesh, Madhya Pradesh, Telangana. To what extent are we seeing, do you think, deliberate undercounting? Or is this more a symptom of, you know, you have weak state capacity, a poor statistical system, an overwhelmed bureaucracy? What do you think are some of the factors going on behind the scenes to lead this kind of variance?
Right. I think it's not any one factor, but a whole host of factors, most of which you listed out. India, even before the pandemic, had a poor health death registration system, which meant that a large number of deaths, particularly in rural areas, would go uncounted. So that's you're already starting off from that position. Secondly, as I said, in villages, people dying at home without ever being tested is a big chunk of people that never make it to the system. However, there is also deliberate undercounting, as we found, particularly in the state of Gujarat. We spoke to death audit committee members. So Gujarat constituted these death audit committees last year to ensure that, you know, death reporting was accurate. And instead, what ended up happening was that it became a tool to undercount deaths. So each district has a death audit committee at the main government hospital, which is supposed to be the auditor of deaths across the district. Now, all hospitals are supposed to send case files to this committee. Not all hospitals do that or send it late. No one's catching them. Then this committee is supposed to look at the case files to determine what they think are deaths due to COVID and what they think are deaths not due to COVID. Some of the people I spoke to on these death audit committees in at least two cities said that there was informal pressure from the top to keep the death count low. And so what they ended up doing was they ended up excluding deaths of elderly people with comorbidities like kidney diseases, heart diseases, diabetes. So a majority of the deaths ended up getting excluded by the audit committee itself. So it's happening at various levels and in various ways. And to actually, you know, get a full extent of it is very hard to say. And I think we'll really never really know how many people died because of COVID.
So Neha, I want to end by asking you about some of the broader implications of your reporting. You know, in your own essay of your family's sort of trials and tribulations, you single out the heroic work of, you know, so-called frontline functionaries, right? Doctors, nurses, sanitation workers, civil society organizations, right? Who are trying to help for those who are sick or in need. And I was sort of struck by the fact that, you know, we often denigrate the local state and local civil society for not living up to a certain expectation. But in this case, it seems that they actually were quite resilient in a way that we typically don't give them credit for. You know, is that a fair takeaway in your view?
Absolutely. But I think in India, we actually have now learned to rely on some of these networks, sometimes much more than the government. A large part of India doesn't expect the government to deliver, And so to not have the system missing is not a surprise, unfortunately. And they have mostly relied on civil society networks to get by. So for instance, last year, when we had a huge crisis of migrant workers who were stranded without food and aid in cities or trying to trek back hundreds of miles home, it was the civil society organizations that stepped up and provided for them much before the government sprung into action. So, India's these informal networks and also like, you know, the NGO networks, which are not informal, are very, very robust here and very often fill in the gaps that the government is unable to provide.
In late April, you and your colleague at the Post, Joanna Slater, wrote a piece on the rising tide of sort of popular disenchantment directed at Prime Minister Narendra Modi. This seems to dovetail with whatever limited polling data we have, which suggests that Modi's popularity has dipped somewhat. You know, we're recording this on June 14th. There's a piece in the New York Times today on this point as well. In recent weeks, the slide, though, seems to have stopped. His ratings have sort of stabilized, at least according to one weekly tracker conducted by the global polling firm Morning Consult. So I'm guessing, you know, if you sort of step back, what is Modi's political standing as the second wave ebbs? How do you see it, right? I mean, it seems like there's a rising tide of anger, but already the government, you know, is talking about how they're willing to share lessons learned for what to do right, you know, with other countries. So is this something that's going to have a lasting impact, do you think?
I think you would be better placed to answer this question than me. But, well, it's hard for me to, you know, make a prediction. However, you know, there are some things we know. And what is that? One is that there is anger, a lot of anger amongst people who are not just critics of the government. These are people who are supporters and who have been lifelong supporters or who are very, very, you know, who have stood by Mr. Modi through many other controversial decisions. So there is definitely anger amongst even his loyal supporters. A lot of them that, you know, we spoke to did say to us that, you know, we'll never vote for him or his party again. You know, that's not something that is necessarily going to be true. However, as you said, the slide seems to be stemming. That could be a function of that the wave is waning and things are looking better and the government is now, you know, revamping its vaccine program, is trying to provide help through other means. So for now, given that the general election is still a couple of years away, it's hard to say whether this will translate into votes or not, or you know, a vote against him or not. And I think your piece in the Post earlier was, you know, reflected that accurately. However, it's this time, the difference is that the lives of people have been touched in a different way. People have lost their friends and family. And so that's not something that is easy to forget, even if the anger subsides. So I would say that the upcoming state elections, particularly in Uttar Pradesh, is going to be a potentially a good barometer, you know, to check whether the anger against Mr. Modi holds and in which form.
Let me maybe end with the follow-up on that. Uttar Pradesh is your home state. You traveled back there during the COVID pandemic to take care of your family. It's a place you've reported from on many an occasion. Without asking you to predict the future, I agree it's totally unknowable how things will go, you know, in the next week in Indian politics, much less next year. But if you, as you think about Uttar Pradesh and, you know, you talk to people there on the ground, was there a sense of an opening for some kind of alternative government at the state level? You know, here's a place where the BJP won, you know, a 3/4 majority. And has ruled the state since 2017. Do you have the sense that there is some churning underway, or is it too difficult to discern that?
No, absolutely. There is definitely a churn. And that churn can be evinced also by what has been happening within the BJP in UP. So while the pandemic was happening, multiple members of their own party in UP, MPs and MLAs, wrote to the Chief Minister Adityanath as well as other party functionaries, pointing out the problems, criticizing the government in a veiled way. Some of the MP and MLAs actually died of COVID. Some of their families, suggested that they didn't receive enough care or not good enough care or not in time. So there has been churn, and that's why we've seen like meetings of top BJP functionaries, in Lucknow and in Delhi. And again, Uttar Pradesh was also one of the worst affected states this time around, unlike last time. And a grim indication of the extent of the crisis was bodies found floating in the Ganga or buried on the shores. So people know that things have been bad. There is anger. Again, a lot in Indian politics also depends on how the opposition bandies together or comes together. Uttar Pradesh has like four major parties. So much of that is also in the political realignment or possible alignments, which will also determine the course of that election, not just BJP's performance, but they definitely do sense that it's not going to be a slam dunk for them as it could have been at any other point of time.
My guest on the show this week is the journalist Neha Masi. She's a Delhi-based correspondent for the Washington Post. She was previously with the Hindustan Times and NDTV. Neha, thank you so much for joining us. I know you and your family have been through a lot. Your reporting has been absolutely invaluable. Thanks for sharing some of your thoughts with us today.
Thanks so much, Milan, for having me and for your ever-sharp questions, some of which you should have answered than me.
Grant Thamashya is a co-production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Hindustan Times. This podcast is an HT Smartcast original and is available on htsmartcast.com, India's fastest growing podcasting producing platform. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate and review. It helps others find the show more easily. For more information about the show and to find the writing we referenced on this week's episode, visit our website, grantthamashya.com. Production assistance comes from Jonathan Kay. Tim Martin is our audio engineer, and Cliff Jayapranada is our executive producer. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
This was a Hindustan Times production, brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.